One of the reasons why I'm sensitive to this because I'm doing this in the Sunday school class, in the adult class as well. One of the reasons why I give extended introductions in a series like this is I'm always sensitive when visitors are in. I think today it's just Pastor Williamson, but one of the things I don't like when a preacher's preaching, if a preacher's in a series, I like to know what's gotten them there and where he's going and so forth, so I try to be sensitive to that. Let's take some time to cover what we've done in this class. 1 Timothy 2:9, we're dealing with Christian modesty. 1 Timothy 2:9 has been the gravitational pull of this class. When Paul says that he would, he wills, and that means really that that it is the Lord's will through him, not only that the men pray everywhere, he adds this statement, likewise, that the women be dressed in modest apparel, with propriety and with sobriety, not with extravagance and immodesty, a paraphrase. And the simple point that we've made right from the beginning is that if there is a call to women to be dressed modestly, then obviously there must be some types of immodesty. And as we, in the first week, looked at the terms for modest and proper and sobriety, we noted, among other things, that this mandate is given for two reasons. Number one, because women can be given to a certain extravagance in clothing. And number two, women could be given to particular sensuality in dress. And remember the language in 1 Timothy 2:9 describing the braiding of the hairs and so forth and so on is language that was used to describe the courtesans or the harlots of the Apostle Paul's day. And the point that we made in this that I want to add and highlight, because it's something that came up yesterday even at the men's meeting, these are not standards that are confined to worship. In 1 Timothy 2 and 3 and verse 15, it's clear that the Apostle Paul is dealing with conduct in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth. And so some have said, well, these standards, particularly regarding modesty and propriety, then only apply to the church. But brothers and sisters, when is there a time that it's right for a woman to be immodest? When is there a time where a man is to be improper with his speech? Because that's what's being addressed. I mean, obviously, the question is ludicrous. It's at all times. But there is to be a heightened and particular demonstration of these matters of holiness in the life of the church, not least that there be no distraction of people in worship. Also, in the first week, we covered some other biblical and theological considerations that I want to stick with you. One is the fact that nakedness, according to Genesis 3, does not mean not a stitch of clothing on. Adam and Eve, you will remember, covered themselves. They covered their private parts. But the text is clear that God clothed them. Now, that does not mean that you've got to try to figure out what kind of tunic God gave Adam and Eve and then make that the standard for today. But the fact of the matter is there's a clothing of more than the private parts that is in that alone that is acceptable to God. And particularly today when we deal with a question that I know would come up regarding swimwear, that's most important. Number two, biblical and theological consideration. When the Bible speaks of uncovering the nakedness, it is in the context of some kind of sexual impropriety. And so therefore it is no coincidence that when there is the uncovering of the nakedness in an immodest culture, that sexual impropriety goes up. I mean, I am shocked and saddened, and I'm continue to be shocked, even though I say I can never be more shocked, by the examples of sexual impropriety in our culture. I mean, when you read the book of Judges, and there was a concubine who was cut into 12 pieces, whose parts were delivered to Israel, you recoil in horror. Folks, we haven't gotten very far from it in our culture today. But sexual impropriety and immodesty go together. And then number three, there is the language of the attire of a harlot. And if there is the language of the attire of a harlot, and that's something that not only godly men are to stay away from, but certainly a godly woman should stay away from, therefore our ladies should seek to avoid being attired in what a harlot would wear. And I would just suggest to you, we are going to get copies of Jeff Pollard's volume, Christian Modesty, and the public undressing of America, but we'd rather make that available to you next year. There's a sense in which this class is not striking the iron when it's hot, Normally, issues regarding modesty don't come up when there's a fall chill in the air, but rather in June and July when it begins to get hot and humid. So we're going to try to make that volume available to you next year. But in Pollard's volume is a very interesting, hardly complete, but a very interesting theology of clothing in the Scriptures. And the ways in which the Lord's redemptive work is described as a dressing and an adorning of his people. And then we dealt with other correlative issues. There were four of them regarding this. Number one, from Romans 12, 1 and 2, the mandate of a Christian in any area is don't be conformed to this age, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. The second is that we do have responsibilities to others and the way we dress. Am I my brother's keeper? The answer is yes. You are your brother's keeper. Now, there is a sense in which, because we are not to be the instrument, particularly ladies, to cause a man to lust, you have a responsibility to others. And men, in the way you comport yourselves as well, that you be an example of masculinity and leadership. Number three, the issue of the heart. And while I put this number third and number three, in a sense, it's primary. Really, this is a matter of the heart. If you buck against what the Scriptures say regarding dress standards, you just chafe and you're not going to listen. I say it lovingly, you've got a real problem with your heart. Because the Lord gives these commands, I don't. And I'm trying purposely to speak in a loving and gracious and gentle manner, saying only what God says in his word. But there are these standards that are given in the Scripture. And the last week that I encourage you to, particularly to dwell on moms and dads with your daughters, is the meaning of true beauty. There have been reprints of volumes done, particularly in the 19th century and the early 20th century, on masculinity and femininity. And I've looked at some of these, and I must confess, maybe it's my own coldness of heart, but I find most of these volumes really leave me cold, even though I'm reading very godly material that I'm sure was very useful at the time. And I've tried to figure out why, and I think it's this. Writers of the past, writing in their culture, I mean, they were writing in a time in the 19th century, quite frankly, people would be, they'd probably want to die if they saw what we wore in our culture today. But they're addressing, in one sense, a different circumstances than we are. And I liken some of these older volumes to kerosene lamps. A kerosene lamp is useful, I guess, if you don't have anything else. But it really doesn't illumine the way you'd like in our day. I much prefer some halogen lamps, and I'm going to mention some that really illumine issues in our day. But actually, Daisy Stavish had given Margaret and me, when she was with us, two volumes, A Beautiful Girlhood, which apparently was a late 19th century or early 20th century standard volume for dealing with women, and then an updated companion guide to Beautiful Girlhood. And what I've looked at in here, again, it's a kerosene lamp, but I found it better than some of the others. I guess it's got a little bit more light in it than some of the others. But I came across this, and it fits so well with the matter of true beauty. And this was written by a woman and revised by a woman. She says, "A desire to be beautiful is not unwomanly. A woman who is not beautiful cannot properly fill her place. But mark you, true beauty is not of the face, but of the soul." Now, that's true whether it's 19th century, 18th century, or 21st century. There is a beauty so deep and lasting that it will shine out of the homeliest face and make it pretty. This is the beauty to be first sought and admired. It is a quality of the mind and heart and is manifested in word and deed. A happy heart, a smiling face, loving words and deeds, and a desire to be of service will make any girl beautiful. Now, let me give you the contrast. And I don't want to stereotype. And I'm not describing anyone in here. But again, I live in the world. And you do see the lush ladies of our culture. By and large, what I have seen is a certain anger, a certain resentment, a way of using my clothing to make a statement. That doesn't make any difference what they're wearing. That's ugly. That's horrible. And so what she says is, know the beauty of a happy heart, a smiling face, loving words and deeds, and a desire to be of service will make any girl beautiful. Now, I've got to say, by and large, that's what I see, and you ladies in the church here. That's one of the reasons why I'm so concerned with the single girls. A pagan out there may despise your Christianity, But you single girls have got a beauty that a pagan would love. And as a pastor, in light of part of the text I'm dealing with today, I'm jealous for you with a godly jealousy that you'd be given to one who loves Christ more than you. But see, there is a beauty in that. A happy heart, a smiling face, loving words and deeds, and a desire to be of service will make any girl beautiful. This is the beauty for which every girl should strive, the beauty that comes from unselfishness and usefulness. Beauty of face and form is secondary in importance, though not to be despised. Now see, our culture says beauty in face and form is what? It is first. If used properly, personal beauty is a good gift. But if it turns a girl's head, it becomes a curse to her. Now again, that's not 19th century, 20th century. It's 21st century as well. No one ever thinks of such trifles when speaking of those who are of great soul. It is the glamour girl or woman whose chief attraction is in face or form. You seek goodness and purity first, then strive to keep the body in harmony with the beauty of the heart. And I think that's great. And so while there may be some kerosene lamps in there, I think that's a good halogen light for our day. Now, that brings us to today. And in the time we have, and I'm not going to promise there's going to be time, what's happened is some questions have come orally and in discussion. And frankly, as I've mulled them over, I think they're probably going to address the questions you would have as well. So let me give you first three practical directives and then deal with some of the questions that have come. First practical directive is to mom and dad. Dads and moms, speak with your sons and daughters about everything in their Christian lives, including their dress. Speak with your sons and daughters about everything in their Christian lives, including their dress. Now, my text, Proverbs chapter 1 through 7. You skip for a minute the specific statements that are there. There's the language of my son, my son, my son, my son. I don't know why it doesn't say my daughter in there. I'm sure that it would have spoken to the daughter as well. But whether it's representing this through male headship or whatever, there is the language of, in the best sense of the word, pathetic entreaty to a son. And it includes a warning that the son not go after the harlot. And the language is explicit. It is graphic. And I say again, without being unnecessarily salubrious in the way we speak, it is imperative, men, that you speak frankly with your sons and moms, with your daughters, about temptation and the way it comes. And write down in chapter 7 or chapter 5 and verses 15 to 20, the very graphic description of the intimacy of marriage. And that's what Proverbs 5, 15 through 20 is, saying, my son, don't you let your fountains be dispersed abroad with every wife. And men in marriage know exactly what that means. And I'm convinced, see, the world is going to be very blunt with your kids. They'll show them how to be harlots, how to be luscious, or how to be buff. You've got to show them how to be modest and holy and begin when they're young. Okay? And dads, I would suggest, I've not gotten to the point with Elizabeth yet where I have to do it, but I'm planning on it. When Elizabeth gets to the point that she's turning from girl into woman, she's got a date with her dad. Before she has a date or courts any other guy, she's going to have a date with her dad. I'm going to take her out and have a talk with her frankly about the way in which she's to be attired, what I expect for her in her own, in the way she deals with men and with others. Because preventive medicine, brothers, is far better than corrective medicine. So speak with your children. Deal with them. Because if you don't deal with them, and then all of a sudden your daughter comes and she's got something that's too low cut or too short and too tight, and all of a sudden you lay down the law, you're going to have a resentful daughter. Now, that's not good leadership. Now, there may come a place where you've got to sit down and backtrack and ask forgiveness for not doing preventive work. But please, preventive work. Create a climate of frankness and openness with your young people from the earliest years. And men, I'm in the same position you are. I know I don't have to commute the way you men do. I think my schedule would rival any one of you in here. My work week is 70 to 80 hours per week. Not only because I love my work, but I'm sensitive to the fact that I'm around men that work 70 to 80 hours a week. And I refuse to be in a situation in which I coddle myself when you men got to work yourselves to death. And what I have to do is I have to make time and take time to deal with each of my young people. I call them pastor visits with each one of them. I've got to just stop. I put it in the schedule. I tell the elders. And I have a pastoral visit with one of my children. And then you are the primary pastors of your young people. Take the time. Do what you do in your business. You make an appointment. You've got an appointment to keep. You can't schedule anything else at that time. And don't say, well, it's my son or my daughter, so I can break it for an appointment. Pray tell, is your business more important than your children? Make an appointment with your son or your daughter and sit down and have a frank talk with them about it, lovingly and graciously, before it becomes a problem. Number two, for the young women. And here I'm quoting from Dana Gresh's volume. Now, Dana Gresh's picture's here, and I think she's a pretty stylish and attractive female. She's a wife, I believe she's a mom, and she has written a book called Secret Keeper, The Delicate Power of Modesty. And we the session has purchased sufficient copies of this volume for parents with daughters, for single girls in the church. I've got them in here. We will give them to you. We want to give them to you. But we also want you, daughters, girls, to read them, and moms and dads, or at least moms, to work through the volume with your daughters. The thesis of this book is excellent. Secret Keeper, The Delicate Power of Modesty. You are keeping the secrets of your body for one man. And that's why you're modest. A beautiful, very biblical thesis. But for the young women, let me quote this woman, so you don't think of a chauvinist or a paternalist who's pushing this down your throat. In the chapter, What Are You Advertising? She says, so what's a girl to do with all the just fashion mentality that advertisers throw her way? And it's that's just fashion, just fashion, just fashion. I'd recommend you start in your closet. Why not take inventory of your wardrobe today? Do this with a friend. It's much more fun and it's important, and it's as easy as 1, 2, 3. You know, if you don't have something as easy as 1, 2, 3, people won't read it in our culture, but she relates to our culture. Number one, this is a woman who writes. She says, make 3 piles. One is the cheap thrills pile. Into this pile, toss all the clothes you've been wearing that invite a guy to complete the picture of your body in his mind. Now, here's what she's getting at. Advertisers know you don't have to show a naked woman. In fact, that'll turn people off. Guaranteed, you put something out with a naked woman on the cover, people don't throw it away. But you put a suggestive picture on the front. And the way we're wired, a man will make the connections. And that's her language. Toss away the clothes that invite a guy to complete the picture of your body in his mind. This includes anything that shows too much skin, short skirts, in other words, short shorts, or shirts, or short shirts is the idea. She's not against shorts or shirts, but the unduly short ones. And low shirts or pants, as well as anything that shows too much shape, tight sweaters, tight jeans, or tight t-shirts. Ceremonially trash these with your friend. Now, I know the argument that comes up. Now, this is Shisko, not Gresh. But this costs money. Brothers and sisters, the Bible speaks about cutting off right hands and plucking out left eyes. And sometimes that means getting rid of something that costs money that's going to cause someone else to sin. Or cause you to sin. Okay. Number two, the second pile is your power pile, into which you'll throw anything, in other words, you keep it, that actually hides the secrets of your alluring body in a fashionable and comfortable manner. She would also say a modest manner. These go back in your closet and drawers. You can use these. She says, these items make up a part of your very high price tag that will require one man to pay a very high price to earn your heart. It's beautiful. You're covering yourself that you would be for one man. And you want a man to work to win your love, not in a conniving way. Number three, the final pile, question mark. That's your fuzzy friend pile. You're a bit fuzzy on these items. They could go either way, so you're going to ask your friend to make the decision for you. Whatever she says goes, don't compromise. Now, I would make an added suggestion. Girls, get your dad and ask your dad, frankly, would this be sensuous to a man? Believe me, a man knows because he's a man. Or sometimes it might be just as good to get an older brother who loves you and he's going to kill anybody that goes after his little sister. And sometimes, see, an older brother will be more frank with you. But anyway, however you do it, I'll do that. And then she has this, get this, the allure of modesty is a great statement. The allure of immodesty is not in what is seen, but what is not seen. Modesty issues a challenge for one man to romantically earn your virtue. So we've got this for you moms and single girls. Please get it. We want you to work through that as well. So that's for our younger ladies. And incidentally, Dad, you're the final authority in the house. Girl doesn't go outside the door with something that's going to tempt a man. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Now, you're going to be better able to enforce that when you've said down the line, earlier on, you've got to realize you're not going to go out the door with something that'll tempt a man. I'm serious, men. Are you so neutered that you won't take up leadership dealing with these issues graciously and lovingly in the home? And this is something for all of you. And I say this in part because while I'm not uncritical of capitalism and free enterprise, and I've got a lot of criticisms of it, I'm a believer that free enterprise in the right place is a good thing. And I'm not being facetious when I tell you that given the fact that conservative Jews, conservative Roman Catholics, and conservative Protestants are now clamoring for modesty, I can't believe that there are not going to be lines of fashion that say unabashedly, this is for those of you who want to be modest. Maybe there are such. I don't know. But I can't believe in our free enterprise system, in our system in which people are looking for niche markets, that there will not be this niche market if there isn't one already. If we've got niche markets for books about modesty, I'm convinced there's going to be a niche market for clothing. Now, that doesn't mean that you go on the web page and look for titles like this. The Amish Boutique. That's not what I'm talking about. Or Frumpy Fashions. That's not what I'm talking about either. Or Dowdy and Dull. That's not what I'm talking about either. I even thought this morning, I'm not a good marketer, but something like this. Pretty and Pure. Or Modest and Modern. That's what we're seeing. And as you learn, and I'm convinced there's going to be places like this. There's a good niche market for Sal Macaluso. See? But if they had that, then encourage one another in those matters. Because again, I'm convinced that this is one of the ways we'll be able to set up a standard in our culture. Now, with that in mind, let me give you some questions, and I'll try to do these quickly, and if we have a few minutes at the end, you can deal with your own questions orally. This one came up by one of the ladies in the church. And the question was this. Doesn't the concept of modesty, and she was speaking of modesty in women, but it would apply to men, also extend to our words? And that was an interesting question. Of course, the answer is yes. The language of modesty means purity, means chastity, it means having standards. And so certainly it would apply to dress, it would apply to anything in the Christian life. Something that's appropriate to the occasion. Now, if you look at 1 Timothy 3 in verse 11, it's interesting. See, in chapters 2 and 3, as I explained to the men yesterday, it's interesting that the bulk of this material isn't dealing with women at all. It's dealing with men and their leadership in the church, leadership that comes in no small measure by word, and that may manifest itself in leadership as a deacon or as an elder in the church. But in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 11, the apostle makes a diversion to speak to either the deacon's wives or to deal with the wives of elders or simply to deal with women in general in the church. But he's not dealing with women as ordained offices, otherwise he'd say it. He simply says, likewise, the women or their wives or the wives must be reverent, not slanderers, temperate, faithful in all things. And the word slanderer is the word for devil. It's the word diabolos. And it means, remember, the devil is an accuser of the brethren. He's a slanderer. He spreads gossip. He defames. Well, that's the idea. The woman, particularly, is to be one who is to be not a devil in her speech. She is to be modest. And I think in 1 Peter 3 and verse 2, when Peter speaks about chaste conduct, He's certainly not just dealing with clothing and with actions. That would include everything. And so a woman's speech, as a man's speech, is not to be reckless, not destructive, not gossip, and not peddling smut about people, but appropriate, careful, and edifying. And I did notice, the book is down in the book room. David, how many copies of Barbara Hughes's The Disciplines of a Godly Woman, that purple one? You had it. I noticed you had it there. Couple, three. I hope you don't have any left by the end of the day. Barbara Hughes's book, written by the wife of Pastor Kent Hughes in Wheaton, Illinois, who pastors a college church. Barbara Hughes has an excellent book called The Disciplines of a Godly Woman, and she has a section in there on propriety that includes propriety in speech. So I would recommend that book. And that, husbands, there's a great book you can get for your wife. You can make it an early Mother's Day gift, or birthday gift, or a late Mother's Day gift, or whatever. But that's a good book to have. So the answer, doesn't the concept of modesty also extend to our words? Question asked by a woman, the answer is yes. Second was a question that came up in the session meeting after the first class, because our elders were concerned that the ladies not feel like they were singled out in this, and I tried to be fair in all of this. And so the question was this: doesn't modesty also include what men wear to worship? And the answer, I don't think that's the main thing in the context here. The scriptures speak of men lifting up holy hands in worship and in prayer, which I don't think has to mean the hands literally go up, but it's holy hands. There's to be holiness in every part of conduct. He doesn't deal with attire there. And I noticed that Sal's survey, and incidentally, Sal's survey is Sal's survey. That's not the session survey. In fact, some of these questions, I think, came because of Sal's survey, but that's okay. But Sal's survey dealt with that. But that comes up, but there is a question about propriety. And if part of the meaning, biblically and in the secular sense, of modesty is what is proper, then I believe the answer is yes. And it's clothing. Now, that automatically, are shorts okay, or long pants, you know, what? Let me show you one text that comes to mind when it comes to the way we are to be attired in the presence of royalty. Look at Genesis 41 and verse 14. Joseph, you'll remember, has been Potiphar's wife and tried to seduce Joseph. Joseph's in a prison. Now, those prisons in Egypt, I mean, it's amazing Joseph lived in those prisons. I mean, your main inmates were rats, and they stunk. You didn't bathe in a prison, and your clothing was tattered. Now, in Genesis chapter 41, of course, Pharaoh has the dream, and Joseph, when he finally finds out, is that Pharaoh is apprised of the fact that this Joseph is able to interpret dreams. And so in Genesis 41 and verse 14, there's this interesting note. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him quickly out of the dungeon, and he shaved, changed his clothing, and came to Pharaoh. Now, I'm not going to use this text and say, if you didn't shave this morning, you're sinning. Or if you didn't change your clothing from yesterday, you're sinning. You can't use the Bible that way. But what's the point? When you're in the presence of royalty, you dress accordingly. And brothers and sisters, it doesn't make any difference to me what a low view of worship we have in our culture. You're in the presence of the King of Kings in worship. And you may think our worship may be a little bit stodgy. Christ Jesus is with us. And you may think the preaching's a little bit long, but Christ Jesus is with us. And you're no less in the presence of royalty than Joseph was before Pharaoh. All I say is dress accordingly. And I would let that work in you as you decide what you're going to do. So that would be my response. Doesn't modesty also include what men wear to worship? And I think that is an important illustration of the fact that this is just a given in a culture. And remember that there is a certain casualness that is certainly human. When you deal with me, you don't want to deal with a robot. You want a certain casualness and openness. But you also want your minister to respect his office. And so the same with believers in their general office. Now, this is one that came up, and I have tried to make it a composite of the questions that have come rather than read one or two. And this is the gist of what's come, orally, primarily. Given that much swimwear is immodest, what should we think of mixed swimming and going to the beach? Now, the Jeff Pollard volume that we'll make available to you next year, because right now going to the beach, unless you're going to go all bundled up to see the waves, is not the kind of going to the beach you're talking about here. But we're talking about going to the beach when there is, quite frankly, nakedness there. But let me give you first an historical note. I'm not sure of the year or the time period. I'm wanting to say the teens of the 1900s, but I may be wrong. Mixed swimming between men and women wasn't permitted in our culture. Pastor Williamson, you're not that old. I know you're not. But can you remember any discussions of this as you've worked through some of these issues yourself? Okay. My understanding, and again, Pollard deals with this in the volume, and I loan mine out to Sal. But mixed swimming used to be prohibited. Now, I'm not saying we should make mixed swimming prohibited. But you see, in an earlier time, when there was more sensitivity to this, this was the standard. Now, I'm not saying that should be ours. I'm just giving you an historical note. Second is a fashion note. Much swimwear puts a female in the place of, speaking biblically, being naked. Much swimwear, much of the swimwear that's present, I mean the really small bikinis, Band-Aid on the top, little patch at the bottom, thong in the back. Brothers and sisters, that's nakedness biblically. Just call it what it is. It's nakedness. My proof, Genesis 3. Eve had a bikini on. She covered her private parts. God clothed her. And again, I don't want to be unnecessarily graphic, but just to make the point, again, this is shameful. If I were in one of your homes, young ladies or moms, and I happened to come out in the hall, and you appeared in the hall in your underwear, you would be shocked. You would be ashamed. And so would I be. Could someone please convince me why less cloth than that is suitable for a beach? I really am open to be convinced that one is different than the other. But you see how our culture has dulled the conscience with respect to one and is increasingly going to dull it with respect to the other. Now, that's a fashion note. So what's my response then to the question, given that much swimwear is immodest, what should we think of mixed swimming and going to the beach? I would assume summer months. My response is in four parts. A. No activity, however culturally accepted, ever justifies the violation of God's will. No activity, however culturally accepted, ever justifies the violation of God's will. That is God's will in this case for our holiness. Now I'll give you an example. I go to a movie. We went to see the Luther film. I was glad to go see the Luther film. It's actually quite good. I mean, I went in part to support it. We were there with, I think, 30 other people on a Monday night, so I was glad for that. And that was a good movie for our children to go to see. Not so the previews of coming attractions. And I wonder, when it says, this review has been approved for all audiences, pray tell, what must the R-rated things be? Now, is it because it's culturally acceptable for 13-year-olds to see people naked from the waist up? Is that then acceptable for Christians? See, brothers and sisters, you don't let the culture call the shots. No activity, however culturally acceptable, can justify the violation of God's will. It's never acceptable for a man to lust. That's why I'm speaking personally, I'm not binding anybody else's conscience. I don't want to be near a beach in the summer. I have to struggle enough with my own problems with lust, that I'm not going to go in a feeding frenzy at the beach. Now, I realize you have the difficulties when you're looking at billboards or when you're in Manhattan. And sometimes that kind of fashion can be even more seductive. I mean, sometimes it's just plain ugly in the swimwear. But lust is never acceptable, nor is immodesty ever acceptable. That's A, response. B, response. Each one must be fully persuaded in his own mind. Romans 14 and verse 5. Now, this isn't a cop-out. Paul's dealing with certain ethical issues and areas of violation of conscience in terms of what you eat and what you don't eat. And he doesn't lay down a lot of laws about what you eat and don't eat. And I'm not going to get up here, and I don't have any right to give you laws about mixed swimming. But you've got to wrestle with the question. And you've got to be fully persuaded in your own mind you can do this in good conscience as a man or as a woman. Number three, or C, I suggest you consider suitable alternatives. Are there not pools you can have in your backyard where there's a certain confinement and what's worn, what's not? I'm not saying you must do that. We don't have that authority. But that doesn't mean you don't swim. And I don't know, maybe there's certain places where you can go where you're not exposed. But think, brothers and sisters, about godly alternatives. And then I would say this, number four. And one man I listened to who dealt with the issue of self-denial or modesty was very helpful on this, emphasized this. And it's so powerful in its impact. Look at Matthew 16 and verse 24. There are parallel texts in Mark and in Luke. Matthew 16, 24. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." Brothers and sisters, have we forgotten that self-denial is part of the Christian life? There are things that as a Christian you simply do not involve yourself with for your own holiness' sake. I'm not saying that mixed swimming is one of those you must deny yourself of. What I am saying is there's many times in our Christian lives we must say no. I have to say no to more films than I can say yes to in our culture. Now, I don't sit here and say, you must say no to these films too. What I am saying is the mandate of self-denial when it comes to holiness does apply to you. And increasingly, if Christians in our culture will say no to all forms of ungodliness and seek to come up with constructive alternatives, maybe there'll be even more niche markets for modesty. But that would be the only point I'd make under the question regarding mixed swimming. And then D, and this I know was prompted, it has come from two quarters. I know it was prompted, Sal, by your well-meant survey, which you're going to deal with next week. I don't want to steal your thunder, because I think I know what you're getting at. But I need to speak as an elder, as a pastor. Are we going to have rules regarding dress? And the answer is, most emphatically, no. This church is committed to the fact that Christ is to be Lord over your conscience. And at various times in church life, we've had the suggestion, among other things, that there be a requirement that if you be a member in this church, you don't have a television. And our elders have said absolutely no. Because Christ is your Lord and we are not. And so we are. Now, we may want to have some house rules regarding men who usher wearing ties. We could have things like this. But when it comes to membership standards and rules, no. On the one hand, we hold to the liberty of the believer. On the other hand, we hold that that liberty is not and never does entail license. On the Westminster Confession, and increasingly as a pastor, not only am I grieved over the libertine character of much Christianity in which anything goes, but I am equally grieved by churches that don't think twice about binding the consciences of God's people about what they eat, what they drink, what they see, what they dress, and what they say. Now, brothers and sisters, the battle with Rome, among other things, was over that kind of usurping the lordship of Christ. God alone is Lord of the conscience and has left it free from the doctrines and commandments of men which are in anything contrary to His word or beside it in matters of faith or worship. I want to plug that Luther film one more time. I shook and I wept as they showed in that film what Martin Luther saw when he went to Rome and the corruption of that evil, diabolical system that made widows and orphans climb on their knees up 40 steps to try to get a few years out of purgatory for their loved ones when they contributed their money. Brothers and sisters, that ought to make you shake and recoil with horror. And it doesn't make any difference who the new Pope is. He's not going to change that system because that's where they get their money. And so thank God for the statement in anything contrary to the Word of God or beside it in matters of faith or worship, so that to believe such doctrines or to obey such commandments out of conscience is to betray true liberty of conscience and the requiring of an implicit faith and an absolute and blind obedience is to destroy liberty of conscience and reason also. As soon as we tell you, you need to keep this law because we tell you to do, because we're your elders. We've not only destroyed your liberty of conscience, we've lobotomized you. Think, brothers and sisters, think in light of the Word of God and wrestle with these issues. I don't have a corner on answering these. I'm not a guru. Christ alone is Lord of the conscience. Now the next section. They who upon pretense of Christian liberty do practice any sin or cherish any lust. And I'll tell you, I wonder about this with ministers. I've heard it from ministers who say, I can go to that R-rated movie with the sexual problems in it because it helps me relate to my people. I can't do it. I don't know, maybe God gave me more hormones. I don't know, but I can't do it. I know enough of my own problems with lust. I don't have to see that guy up there fulfilling it. Do thereby destroy the end of, or cherish any lust, do thereby destroy the end of Christian liberty, which is, now listen to this, brothers and sisters, that being delivered out of the hands of our enemies, and that includes a fashion industry that would make, we might serve the Lord without fear in holiness and righteousness before Him all the days of our life. That's beautiful stuff. That's not antiquated one bit. You don't think that's relevant to today? That's beautiful, the balance that's there. See, Pastor Williamson, I know I'm not typical OPC because I get worked up about these things, but I believe them with every fiber of my being. Yeah, there you go. Good. Okay, excellent. So rules, no. You see, brothers and sisters, you've got to avoid the Pharisee in each one of us, Pharisee and libertine. Okay? So the Pharisee will say, I've got to have rules, got to have rules, got to have rules. I mean, you have your own personal standards you keep, but you don't bind someone else with them. Or there's the libertine in us. Leave me alone. I'm not going to be bothered, see? Okay? So avoid both the Pharisee and the libertine within us. Incidentally, one of the good things to do, and then I've got one more question, then I'm done. Ask yourselves questions. This is in the companion guide to beautiful girlhood and the discussion questions and a conversation on dress. See, ask yourselves questions. This doesn't take rules. Listen. Are your clothes modest? Do they reveal too much? And I added some others. How much is exposed? How is it exposed? Why is it exposed? Now, what I would wear when I work in the garden, I'm not going to wear when I come to worship. And one's appropriate to one, one's appropriate to the other. Do I like to startle or cause a stir? Would a modest woman wear this? Could I give boys or men the wrong idea with this item of clothing? Am I doing my duty in allowing or wearing this particular garment? A good question. Am I safe from base comments in wearing this? I mean, what do the guys say when they look at you, girl? I added another one. What statement am I making? Or is what I am wearing appropriate to the occasion? You know, in Song of Solomon, I mean, that woman was wearing garments that attracted her husband. And that was very appropriate to that occasion. And as I mentioned to the men yesterday, one of the most touching phrases regarding a woman is in Ezekiel. I'm going to take away the desire of your eyes. Your wife, men, one wife, that's the desire of your eyes. And women, you're preparing your bodies for that one man. You are the desire of his eyes. Not a promiscuous desire for many eyes. Now, again, if a man lusts when you're dressing modestly, that's his problem. And then finally, and I've got 3-4 minutes. What do I do if I see someone in church dressed immodestly? Now, this question came before Sal's question prompted it. So I don't want to steal your thunder, but what do I do if I see someone in church dressed immodestly? And these have come to me. They've come to our elders. And so this applies in many areas, and mark it down. My fellow elders, the way we're going to deal with people when it comes. What do I do if I see someone in church dressed immodestly? Remember, the general rule, and I don't mean a double entendre when I use the first word here. The general rule, whenever there's an infraction, is you either cover it or confront. And by cover, I'm not dealing with dress here. But when there's an infraction, love covers a multitude of transgressions. I'm the most public person in this place. And if everybody picked me up on every infraction, I would just want to crawl in a hole and never come out. I'm thankful you're a loving bunch, and you have to cover a multitude of transgressions with your pastor. But if you can't cover it, then you must confront it. And in any area, in dealing with a brother or sister, those are the only two options. It's not cover, carp about, or confront. Or you either cover it or confront. And incidentally, under this question, what do I do if someone in church is dressed immodestly? We're not going to have fashion police in this church. If you're going to focus on whether somebody's dressed immodestly all the time, you think more about God than others. But what do you do? What if you're going to confront? You see someone, and either A, it is so clearly immodest and so clearly making the statement of the attire of a harlot, we'll say, that you must confront it, or there's a pattern like this. What do you do? Well, you're going to follow Matthew 18:15. Someone sins in your presence, you go tell him his fault or her fault just between the two of you. Now, how do you do that? Seek counsel if you need to about the issue, but not the person. Don't come to me and say, I saw so-and-so, and she was dressed in. You might say, Pastor, I have seen someone I believe is dressed immodestly. Could you give me some pointers on how to deal with it? Don't go to anybody on that first step and say, I've seen so-and-so. Then you're gossiping. What if she wasn't dressed immodestly? Are you prepared to go and ask forgiveness for slandering her? I need to know how to deal with this issue. And we're always thankful to give you counsel about this. We've got to do it all the time. Seek counsel regarding the issue, but not the person. Number two, be sure it's a clear violation or a pattern. And if it's a half an inch above the knee, and that's immodest to you, I'm not convinced that's really immodest. Make sure it's a clear violation or it's a pattern. Increasingly pushing the envelope. I don't know what it would be. But see, be sure, brothers and sisters, when you bring a case, you've got to be able to defend it. I would suggest in the third place, it is best for women to deal with women. In one case where I've had to deal with an issue with immodesty, I dealt with it with my wife. Not because she was immodest, she wasn't, but she and I dealt with a particular person for whom we were concerned. Because I personally am very uncomfortable dealing with a woman about her dress. And I'm not usually uncomfortable about dealing with people, but that can quickly become improper. And I think here, ladies, Titus 2, verses 4 and 5, the older women are to admonish the younger women to, among other things, be sober, and that's one of the terms used under dress, sobriety, and chaste. And so I would say, ladies, if there's a pattern, and I think here it is legitimate, husbands, to say to your wife, I've been concerned about so-and-so, would you be willing to do it? However you do it that way. And then, as necessary, also speak with the parents. I believe that's right. I think you can say, I want you to know I've spoken with your daughter, or I believe I need to deal with your daughter. But when they're under the parents' roof, there is a certain responsibility parents have for that matter. So that might be helpful in that. And then I would add with this, and then I'm done. Please don't do it with our visitors. Now, a question came up the other day, and Sal, who loves to tweak us, raised, well, what if somebody came in a bikini? You know, and he said, well, you'd call Creedmoor and say there's some crazy person who came to church. And there may be a lot of truth in that. And I don't know what we do. I mean, that hasn't come. I guess I could see a case if a woman came in and she looked like she was getting ready to go advertise for a girly magazine. We might say, wear a shawl. I don't know. But brothers and sisters, if you have someone who comes to church and they don't even know what the Christian faith is all about, mortify the tendency, or if you're a man, if she's dressed in a lustful way, not to look at her, and pray that the Lord, thank God she's sitting under the preaching of the Word of God, and pray the Lord change your heart. I'm going to close with this, then you guys have come. I don't know if I told you these stories. We've had two occasions that I remember in this church life over my 23 years here. One many years ago, goes back in the era of hot pants. I don't know, when was that, Sal? 81 or 82? They're coming back. The 70s? I wasn't here that time. She must have been a carryover. And I was about 82, 83. Whatever they call them, they were short. And this gal sat right over, Andrea's not you, but sat over right about where Andrea was. But not dressed at all the way Andrea is, I guarantee you. And she began to come to prayer meeting. And I had to look in the other direction. This was when we had prayer meeting downstairs. I had to look the other direction. God took a hold of her heart. And I'll tell you, it was but a few weeks, and she threw out all that stuff, and she dressed with a beauty and a propriety because her heart was right. The heart of the matter is a matter of the heart. The other was a case with a young lady, and this gal dressed like a harlot. When she came to the door, that's what you would have thought of. And she was living with a guy, and that's really what harlot she's like. God took a hold of her. She was converted. We knew the first thing we needed to do, and she knew to get her out of that living situation. We got her with one of our senior saints. And I'm not going to tell you who it was, because you might figure who the person was. And that senior saint took that dear girl under her wing and coached her about how to dress. And we saw the changes come. Now see, there's some examples of how you deal with those outside of Christ. And that's a peripheral thing. It's important. But deal with the heart first, okay? All right, man, if you'll come forward while you're doing that, Jim and Eric, let me put you guys to work. I have done a very brief bibliography of volumes either that I have read or perused. In most cases, I've read them, that deal with modesty and related issues. Now, David, let me try this. See if this flies for you. If you find, I suggested to David some of these books to order and a number of copies. I don't know the prices on each of them. But if you're interested in one or more of these books, David, may they note that on the sheet and then give it to you and regard that as an order. Okay? I would highly recommend, remember, ladies, please, please don't hesitate to ask for Secret Keeper. If you're parents of a daughter, or you are a daughter, and I know if you're a girl, you have to be somebody's daughter, single girl, Secret Keeper, that's free for you. I want to highly recommend for our ladies on the list, Dana Gresh's companion volume and The Bride Wore White, 7 Secrets to Sexual Purity. This is one book, unless there's a better one than this that comes out before Elizabeth is in her teenage years, that I want Margaret to work through with Elizabeth, or I'll work through it. But this is an excellent book, not written by a frumpy female. I mean, this is an attractive Christian woman, and there is a lot of very frank, open, godly sagacity in this book for our young ladies. So I highly recommend that. Okay. Hey, I did it pretty well today, fellas. Not bad.